the Honorable Buyani. And then we have an apology from the Honorable Ria, who was studying here. And then we have an apology from the Honorable Masogo, who is our county business. And then we have an apology from the Honorable Kadebi, who's here, right here in Parliament. He's coming in any minute. And the Honourable Flanguini, who has indicated she will be running, she's running a bit late. So those are the two late apologies. I'm not sure of other members of the committee, the Honourable Esterhazy on energy, the Honourable Albert.
I didn't see that. Party business. And that's it. Right. So we have two more members who will be here shortly, all right? And that's going to give us, seven members, which will be sufficient to take a decision, committee decision, with respect to the treaties as we get briefed. There is one thing that you should know before we adopt the agenda. And that is, on the briefing, you'll note the Marrakesh Treaty. We won't be taking a decision on Marrakesh today. We will be briefed on Marrakesh. And we will explain that as we go through during the briefing on Marrakesh itself. So on that particular point, we would like to propose the adoption of the agenda. Honorable Tierke, seconded by the Honorable Hadebe. Thank you. We have now got, and we'd like to welcome you, Minister Dr. Rob Davies. You've brought with yourself a large team, thank you. The DG, Mr. Lionel October, the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Khan, the Acting Group Chief...
Sorry, Chair. Just on a point of clarity, how can you adopt the agenda with five members when you need six?
You're quite right procedurally. No, to take a decision, any decision... You may open a committee, but I know the Honourable MacPherson is correct. We need six members, right? And the Honourable Flanguini is not here yet. As soon as she comes in, we'll adopt the agenda, but we will proceed with the business. Thank you very much for that intervention. We certainly don't want anything invalidated purely as a result of a procedural error. Ms. Matamela, the Acting Group Chief Operating Officer. Mr. Zakodo, I saw him, Zakode, the Deputy Director General, Special Economic Zones and Economic Transformation. Mr. Harnival, the Chief Economist, Ms. Mangoli, the Chief Operating Officer, the Chief Operating Officer, Incentive Development and Administration Division, IDAD, Mr. Madupe, the Chief Director in the Media, Ms. Pele, Acting DDG, Industrial Development Division, and is this correct, Mr. Ibrahim?
Yeah.
Did I see him? I did see him earlier. Yes, I did. The Chief of Staff in the department. But before that, I should have addressed the other members on the other side, Ms. Mishendran Padiachi, the CCRD, and the DTI Deputy Director, IP Policy and Law. We've mentioned Petchi, have we? No, we haven't. Ms. Kadi Petchi, SIPC, senior manager, creative industries. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then you've got Miss Sharon Osman, chief director, product development, at the back.
Yeah.
All right. Yes, there we are. And with us as well, we also have Miss Mabramisi Misa, Director Legal Support CCRD. I didn't see her offhand. All right, in front, Miss Makata Mahloli, Chief Director IDD Agro Processing, and the rest we'll announce later. And we've got Miss Saraj Naidu, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer for DTI. Minister, on that note, we are going to proceed and ask you to brief us on SONA and budget as it relates to the DTI mandate. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me say we've got about 70 slides which we're going to rush through. Mostly, I think we put the slides together to provide you with the information, not necessarily we're going to speak to them. I want to just start off by saying that I think an enormous amount of the SONA did speak to work that needs to be done by the DTI as we move forward. As you will recall, a significant part of it was about economic recovery. A significant part of it was about moving through this episode of state capture and corruption and addressing frontally all of the matters with a view to ensuring that we have public institutions that do the job that they need to be doing, which is pretty critical in our area. We had quite a lot of talking about the need to promote more export-led growth and the African continent in particular, and the African Continental Free Trade Area that was referred to in the speech. That's also pretty central to our work. And then also localization and capturing a larger part of the domestic market for locally produced goods and services. That was also referred to, and that's a pretty critical part of our industrial policy efforts. So, and then there was, of course, the investment story. In the debate, of course, I think a lot of these themes were taken up in one shape or form. So what we're going to do is just talk briefly about, this is, of course, the last of these presentations that will be given at in this term of Parliament, this fifth Parliament. This is an annual event, as you all know. We thought also we would just reflect a little bit on where we think we've left the department at the end of this term, what needs to be picked up in the next administration, and so on. So first of all, the global economic context, then something of the domestic economic context, some reflections on manufacturing performance, and then what have we done, our interventions, and what have we managed to do, what have we not managed to do, and then some strategic issues. So very quickly on the global context, I think that we all know that we're going into every international agency, IMF, World Bank, OECD, and everyone is telling us is a year in which we should expect global economic growth to be somewhat down on what it was last year, and that there are downside risks. And these downside risks are at least the following, as they down there. The so-called trade wars between the U.S. and China, but also having a number of us in collateral damage, so with the steel and aluminium tariffs, which we got some respite from. Now the question of 232s on autos is now in the White House, and we don't know what decision is going to be taken on those. But I think that also we need to understand that although there are discussions going on right now and that there's some expectations that there will be some agreements to withdraw from some actions, the point that was made by the head of the World Economic Forum Klaus Schwab when he came to the event organized by the president last year, when he said that he believed that behind these trade wars was ultimately a battle over leadership over the fourth industrial revolution. I think he said mastery of the fourth industrial revolution, and I think there's a lot of indications that that's what it's about in the end of the day. Technology, who's going to be running 5Gs and all of the things that go with that. So I think that this is something that's going to likely to be around. We've got against that background slowdowns in China and in the US, expected slowdowns, Brexit uncertainty, and then what we call diverging trade growth trends in the in the EU. Now in China we're talking about a slowdown to 6.6%. Now if we had 6.6% growth, I think we'd think everything was fine. And of course 6.6% of what the Chinese economy now is probably worth a good deal more than 10% was 5 years ago, so the size of the base. But nonetheless, there are concerns that there may be some slowing down, the trade wars, but also other things in the Chinese economy that could happen. And if it does, I think that we may find that there are implications for world growth. But, you know, we're saying that there may be there are a number of indications that China's economy will continue to be robust. In the U.S., there are indications from the Federal Reserve that the growth may be lower and that this doesn't take account of things like the government shutdown. And some analysts are saying that there could be a fairly mild recession this year in the U.S. So I think that we need to take that into account. In the EU, Germany, the leading economy in the EU, not performing as well as it should have or could be doing, with the auto industry particularly highlighted. And then Brexit. I think Brexit, whatever difficulties we may have with Brexit and trade, and, what I can say is that we are close to reaching an agreement with the UK. The outstanding issues are matters of accumulation, which are quite important in the auto industry. That's recognition of inputs coming from the EU after the UK leaves, UK inputs and inputs from us, as well as things like permits for sanitary and phytosanitary matters. We think we're going to conclude those very, very quickly, and we will have to bring a very, very quick proposal to yourselves to ratify if there's any chance, which may well be the case, of what's called a hard Brexit. But it's more than that. I think that the difficulties in the auto industry in South Africa as a result of Brexit pale into insignificance compared to the difficulties there'll be in the European Union itself and what implications that would have. Then, looking at South Africa, well, we exited what's called a technical recession in the third quarter of 2018. Manufacturing actually performed quite well. Manufacturing, I think, is quite volatile and very sensitive to other things, but that's what happened in the fourth quarter. There you are, manufacturing of the productive sectors held up quite well, but the fastest growing sectors were the non-tradables, where you know, these things that hit the real economy, these tariff issues and global overproduction are not so important there. Then if we look at the coming into the performance of manufacturing, I think we have to exit this term saying that, we'll exit the two terms when we've had industrial policy, formal industrial policies with the industrial policy action plans. I think what we want to say is that we haven't achieved, and let's acknowledge that up front, we haven't achieved placing value-added production and manufacturing at the heart of a new higher growth trajectory, but nor have we just seen continuous deindustrialization. In fact, I think if you look at that graph, you will see that manufacturing value added was 14.3%, it's gone down to 12.3%, but it's basically flat. We managed it went down during the period of the onset of the global economic recession. It then came up and has been flat, which is where we are. We're saying that this has been against a background of quite considerable headwinds. They have included the global financial crisis, the end of the commodity super cycle and the collapse of mining procurement and investment, the global glut of steel and all sorts of other challenges, and then challenges in our own market, particularly in electricity and electricity pricing. We've been highlighting this issue of administered prices for a considerable period of time. So whatever we've achieved has been against that that headwind. Employment fell, but we've stabilized. I think that's what we want to say, is that we've managed to stabilize rather than to expand, and that there is some employment growth in the fourth quarter employment figures, as you've seen, there is some stabilization of employment, but not more than that. But also to make the point that in manufacturing, we are seeing the application of technology. We have been for some years. Manufacturing is becoming much less employment intensive around the world, including in South Africa in its own right. But when we look at the employment impact of manufacturing, we've also got to take into account the impact it has on other subsectors. So manufacturing and value addition is very, very important to service sectors as well as to primary sectors as well. Where we've seen an important advance is we've seen manufactured exports have been growing substantially. They've been driven by the auto products, but auto industry products are quite significant components of our export basket. There are some figures on that. What we acknowledge as well is that manufacturing investment is growing too slowly. I think the summary I would make of this is that we have said before in the current iteration of IPAP, and let me say the next one will come out in the next administration, but in the current iteration of IPAP, we said that we believe that where we have acted purposefully, where we've acted in concert, we've acted on the basis of evidence, we have had a positive impact on the performance of manufacturing. But overall, we haven't been on the scale or have been able to confront all of the headwinds that have acted against our achievements. So here are a few what we would want to say are impacts that we've had, positive impacts. The auto program. I think the auto program is something which we will be handing over, which is a significant achievement. We've got a master plan in the auto sector to 2030, and the master plan is looking to a trajectory in which the level of localization, the level of local components in vehicles assembled in South Africa will rise from the current just under 40% to 60%. To achieve that, among other things, is a change from the value-added allowance to something called the value-added localization allowance. The formula has completely changed, and the gist of it is that after a transition, which we've figured in, if you don't take steps to improve the level of local component manufacturing, you will receive less benefits than you receive now. To retain the benefits, you have to deepen the level of localization. And that allows the emergence of more component manufacturers. Component manufacturers are more job-creating than the OEMs. Of course, if there are no OEMs, there's no component industry. It also allows for new entrants, and particularly smaller black-owned companies, into those value chains. And I think that what we saw in that and that change that we made in the auto program was a high level of consensus that emerged. The auto manufacturers, the component manufacturers, and the trade union, that's the largest trade union there, which is NUMSA, which is, I think that was a significant achievement. We've got a similar exercise now in the clothing and textiles sector, exactly retail clothing and textiles, development of a master plan there. But we can say that the clothing and textiles competitiveness program resulted in 95,000 jobs being retained and 22 factories being established in leather and footwear. We've got a significant business process service sector, which provides jobs for young people and entry-level jobs. There are the figures for those. And then the steel value chain has been stabilized under circumstances in which I will have to say that there was a very real possibility at some stage that we would cease being a steel manufacturer in South Africa. That we could have ended up a few years ago without steel manufacturing in South Africa. I don't know whether people are aware of the disaster that would befall the country if we ended up there. Not only would we move and regress from being an iron ore producer with steel manufacturing back to just being an iron ore producer, an exporter of dirt out of the ground, we would have regressed. Not only would we not be beneficiating but regressed, but more than that, we don't have the port capacity in South Africa to import all the steel that would be needed for the downstream industries, which would suffer. We would have had massive deindustrialization in South Africa. So I think that the hard decisions that we took in the steel industry, where we've seen a turnaround, the hard decisions that need to be taken now on things like export taxes, which were announced in the budget, to ensure that we can actually ensure that scrap metal-based smelting industries are supported in this country. Those are necessary, because without a steel industry, you don't have downstream activity. So there are some of the pictures on autos, clothing, textile, footwear, leather, on agro-processing, which is a key part of the agricultural value chain, where there's lots of jobs that could be realized. And then on the localization, well, I'm sure that all honorable members will recall what I was saying in the debate on the SONA. The gist of it was that where we have a number of designations in place, localization designations, where those have operated and functioned, they have supported investments by both multinational companies as well as by local companies as well as by black industrialist companies who have geared up their operations to supply the local products procured by government agencies. It has created, supported, and sustained jobs. But we have had too much leakage, put politely and in a diplomatic way. We've had fraud, corruption, and state capture, which has meant that in some cases contracts have not been given according to the localization prescripts. Absolutely all of the BEN contracts, somebody must tell me one that isn't like this, absolutely all of them have supported imports over local production, and they have also acted to the detriment of suppliers in supply chains, including black-owned companies, who have been affected because they didn't get the business that they were supposed to get. So our commitment is to put that right. We've worked with the Auditor General. The system is in place now. You don't follow procurement, you're going to have a negative audit finding. Now, under the new Audit Act, you are going to have to answer more robustly, let me put it that way, than you would have had to do before. And also we're looking to beef up our own surveillance and partnerships with business and labor. Who do you know who's not getting a business because it's been given to some other consortium? Let's address that. So I think that we can say where localization has worked. We've said also there will be more localization designations. We've indicated some of the areas where they will be, and we've also said that we are looking, as I said, to improve enforcement. So there are some other examples of where there's been localization. One of the good examples is shipbuilding. Yeah, Cape Towns. Look at that picture. These are new vessels that are going to be manufactured, procured here. No, you know, nips and dips and arms deals. This is local manufacturing that has benefited. SA Shipyards, there was there wasn't a shipbuilding industry in 2014. It was on its uppers. It was on its last legs. Now you can see what's happened with the business that they've been given. And then on the black industrialists, as you recall, we've been trying to turn the BEE program in the course of, at least since the 2013 Bill Act that's now in place and the codes, we've been trying to turn it to support more black companies involved in actual productive activity by saying that there are sub-minima for supplier development, there's a sub-minima for skills development and so on. But we've also said that we need a particular program in to target and support black industrialists. So there's what we say now, 131 black industrialist projects have been approved by the DTI for the DTI incentive. There's another number you'll get, which are people who have gone to IDC for a capital loan. The ones who have got the incentive have leveraged about 13.2 billion rand of investment, they've created 9,500 jobs and retained 8,900. I did indicate in my budget speech last year that we would have a meeting with the black industrialists. We've had that meeting, and we said that the program would involve, segmentation. So we'd have new entrants, we'd have smaller business people as well, but we'd also put money back in to some of the ones we've already provided so they could take themselves up to the next level. Let me say, many of them said, we don't want your money so much, we want you to follow through with other things, buy our stuff. And that's where some of the localization work has to take place. So this one here, Yakani, is the one I often quote. This company invested 1 billion rand in an ICT factory. There it does Explorer decoders, TV sets, set-top boxes, and also PC tablets for schools and things like that. It's in the East London IDZ. It was described to me as the most advanced plant of its kind in Africa for sure, and most likely in the Southern Hemisphere. That is what it was described to me as. They will be taking on 1,000 new people from the East London area. That is a remarkable investment, whoever does it. The fact that it is 100% black owned by Dr. Knelle, who's passionate about this industry, it tells us something about the black industrialist program. So there we are, about what we'll do going on. The fourth industrial revolution, it's on us. It's on us in manufacturing. You see that fellow there standing there with a white coat and in a machine. With all due respect to people who wear red overalls, I see more people like that in factories than people with red overalls. There are people in white coats and they're operating some ICT equipment. That's what it is. Sometimes people will say, and this is one of the issues about jobs, they'll say we've taken human error out of quality control. What does that mean? You unpack that. Well, there used to be people sitting on the line and weeding out the rejects, and now they've got a machine, an ICT machine that does it. That's what's happening. Robotics, artificial intelligence, maybe we're not quite there at the level of artificial intelligence, but certainly digital processes in manufacturing, even in South Africa are here. We've got to get ourselves ready for that. So here are some of the things that we're doing. We're working in collaboration with the rest of government and a process that's led by the Department of Communications. But ultimately, we're looking at investments in ICT-enabling technologies, also the spread out of these technologies in ways that are going to benefit entrepreneurship and small business development. But here we've got companies that are manufacturers. I went to another one here in Cape Town, by the way, they are making complex circuit boards, which have been used in two things. They've been used in the SKA, the SKA telescopes, and they've also been used in the Hadron Large Computer, Large Accelerator in Switzerland. Now, the SKA will be looking at the theory of the big, the expansion of the universe. The Hadron Large Scale Collider is looking at the theory of the small, at the Higgs boson particles. So South African products are at the cutting edge of the debates on physics in the world. So there we are. So you know, we have capabilities. Here's on liquid petroleum gas, and you know, these things. The gas industrialization program doesn't depend and didn't depend on the discovery that was made the other day by Total. You know, we've been preparing for this, and the SEZ in Richards Bay is particularly preparing itself around liquid petroleum gas, create electric power. Another thing that can happen, and I think is going to happen, is that we're going to have industrial machines run off gas instead of run off electricity, and household equipment. More people will probably start cooking on gas and things like that. That's what's going to happen. And then there's chemical industries that can come. We've got a chain of work on gas industrialization, which, as I said, even if we don't have a single bit of gas in South Africa, we don't have a single litre of gas, neighboring countries do, and it makes a lot of sense. There's the steel industry. There's BPS. Now, on investments, I think that the story on investments is one where we have managed something quite remarkable. I said in my input, UNCTAD has the World Investment Report. They told us that that foreign direct investment was down last year by about 20-odd%. Greenfield's investment was down by 14%. But in the case of South Africa, we went from $1.3 billion to over $7 billion. That's where we went to in foreign direct investment. That's a 4.5 times increase, or 450% increase. That's a remarkable achievement. We bucked the trend. We bucked the trend because we managed to build greater confidence among investors across a number of fronts. But also, I think it's very important to say that confidence was also built on partnerships and a role of government and government agencies, not just in addressing red tape, but also in bringing real things to the party. Investors want infrastructure. Investors want to ensure that the labor force is there in sufficiently trained quantities. Investors want to see all sorts of things that we have to provide as government. What this $7 billion was only a part of $20 billion, which is, if you want to translate the commitments made at the investment conference into dollars, it's $20 billion, 300 billion new rand, about $20 billion US dollars. So that means that there was a much larger figure that was mobilized, including domestic investments. Now, you know, some of this, we just wanted to indicate, is not just paper pledges, something you say you didn't get to say anything at the conference unless there was a stress-tested commitment. And some of these things are following through. End of this week, the president will open phase one of the Vedanta investment in the Northern Cape. It's part of a billion rand investment, which will eventually lead to a zinc smelter and possibly also to a fertilizer plant. All of these companies in the next bullet, Amazon Web Services, that's $1 billion investment. Mara Phones, that's cell phones, that will be in the Dubai Trade Port. Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble are responding directly to this thing about sanitary towels. That's what they're going to be investing in that. So it's the zero rating, and they're also making some contribution to the free rollout. Exaro. Hisense is going to expand in Atlantis, Defy in Esitebi in KwaZulu-Natal, and then there's some others down there at the bottom there. All of these actually are announcements and rollouts that we're expecting, many of them even before the election, but certainly in the first three quarters of this year, all of them. Then we've got the Invest South Africa, the one-stop shop, plays a critical role in all of these. There you are, how many it's facilitated, how many inquiries, but we've got three provincial ones. KZN was the first one, Western Cape was the second one, Gauteng is the third one, and then this year we're going to have more, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Northern Cape, and the Free State, so we'll have seven in the course of this year, provincial offices. Then there was quite a bit of mentioning on the industrial parks, industrial park revitalization. This is a case of relatively small investments, large returns. These places exist, and they have significant numbers of people invested in them and employed in them. When I went to Botswana, I was quite surprised that 10,000 people worked there. It's not like a small number. And there are a variety of companies, normally medium-sized businesses or small businesses, many of them black-owned businesses that are working there. So by turning these places into a more significant area, by addressing the security, the lighting, the roofing and stuff like that, and using local contractors to do the work, we've been able to modernize quite a number of them. And I think that is helping industrial decentralization. Here's the ones, and there you are, starting with the one in Botswana, was the first one. The 10,000 jobs. There are the jobs. The one in Isithembe is even more, 25,000. There's significant numbers of people that are working in the ones. These are the ones where the program has already gone to. And there we've spent 511 million rand on those, and they've all been launched, or the modernization program, and they're four ready to be launched in the current year. Now there are phases of this. We're talking about what sort of incentives, and this was mentioned by the president, what sort of incentives can we be launching for the investors in there? There's an association now being formed, and there's consultation. So here are a few pictures. I'm not going to go through those. On the special economic zones, we now have, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10. The last that were announced or been agreed to, Nkomazi in Atlantis. Atlantis was launched by the president at the end of last year. What all of them are beginning to do is to, attract investments. And here are the investments. There's a case of operational investors. Those are the ones that are already there. And these are, and then there are a number who have signed some sort of agreement. If we manage to push those agreements to an investment, there's a quantum of additional investment that we can get. And I think that what this points to, this is the work that we can do. This is insight. This is within our grasp to increase that investment in all of those. So actually there's a lot of work going on. How do we re-dynamize a number of these? But here they are, the projects. I'm not going to go through the list of all of them. And there's some pictures. There's the build of some of these as well. So where do we go now? Trade promotion. Export-led growth. Export-led growth depends on actively identifying opportunities and then acting on those opportunities and trying to support businesses to take advantage of them. So, there's an ongoing piece of work, trade missions, national pavilions. We've assisted 800 enterprises, and they have recorded about 4 billion rand of export sales. There's been all kinds of engagements at the level. There's BRICS and so on. Let me just say on this one that we'll come to it later on, but the African continent is critical. We've got a particular approach there. Then just to say I said this is the last of these we'll do. So we pay attention to the indicators of the department, the institution. What sort of institution do we run? And so first of all, a clean audit. Let me say a clean audit doesn't come on a plate. A clean audit happens because you decide you want it. And then you go and address the issues that are raised by the Auditor General. So, the DTI and many of the entities have now secured clean audits, not just the smaller ones. Let's take the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. When I became the Minister of Cipro, Cipro as it then was, Cipro had a bent tender for ICT. We ended up going to we ended up going to Scopa about it. We sat there in Scopa. The company should never have been given a tender. I took the decision we're going to cancel the tender. We're not going to have any tolerance for this. We cancelled it against a lot of pushback. Now, the CIPC has achieved a clean audit. There's quite a turnaround in that institution. So those are the sort of pillars that we speak about. So three clean audits in a row in the DTI and also the entities. All of that is important because it means that we are showing that the public money which has been entrusted to us, I think it's about $7 billion now that we've got for incentives, that money is distributed where it's supposed to go to support industrial development and growth. So there's the incentive program, there's where the money's gone. We all eligible creditor payments within 30 days, we do that. How about gender equity? The senior management and the DTI, 52% female against our target of 49%. This, I think, is pretty much where the demographics are at. The number of people with disability, well, we're over 2%, but we went up a little bit as well. Then on the regulatory environment, a few issues there. We've been automating and digitizing a number of these. If you want to register a company in South Africa now, you just go to a bank or you go to ICT, you can do it. Your fingerprint is valid, you pay your money, it's instantaneous, actually. It's within minutes. That's what happens now. Now the CIPC is beginning to move. I said to them, the transition is now from being a register to be a registry office to being a regulator. That's where they're moving. There's a number of other indicators there. Regional integration, this is where the Africa region comes in. We want to promote exports wherever we can, wherever there's an opportunity. But I think we have to acknowledge as well that it's going to be tougher and tougher to get value-added products into the developed world, into the United States and places like that. Not just because of restrictions, but also because they're not growing. So what is China doing? China's turning to its domestic market. India's turning to its domestic market. We don't have a big enough population or big enough incomes as individual countries. But as a continent, we do. We hit the figures. 1.2 billion people, over $3 trillion US dollars. We hit the figures. Put it another way, China had the good fortune not to be divided up into 54 countries under colonialism. That's the reality. So regional integration becomes very important. But what approach? Our approach, and this is a big ongoing debate that resurfaces all the time, do we just go for market integration, which is the EU model? You go from a preferential trade area to a free trade area, a customs union, a common market, an economic union. You go in linear succession. And it's all about tariff regimes. Do you have a common external tariff and all that? And we've argued that is not appropriate because the small levels of intra-regional trade on the African continent are not just about the tariff regime. They're about underdeveloped production structures that most countries produce and export some primary product to the rest of the world and don't make all kinds of other things. And it's about underdeveloped production structures and inadequate infrastructure. And development integration says it's not all about trade integration. It's about combining all those into a pillar that works. And so we've been saying, our view has been that what we need to seek is to broaden integration at FTA level, not more than that. There's an ongoing debate about that. FTA level to encompass the whole of the continent while we also address all of those things. Yeah. And so for South Africa, why is this important? Well, 30% of our total exports go to the continent, the rest of the continent, $311 billion. Two-thirds of those, 63% of value-added products, one-third, two-thirds. One-third of exports to the rest of Africa, two-thirds of those are value-added products. We run a surplus with most countries. We supply these products. But where do we see the future line? Not just in South Africa supplying finished products to the rest of the continent. We want the rest of the continent to industrialize. That will mean that some of the finished products we currently supply to the other countries will be made by other countries. But we can also see the emergence of regional value chains. Mm-hmm. And regional value chains will probably allow more trade in intermediate products, which is critically important because that's the growing part of international trade. And that's a more complex form of activity. That's where we want to go. So these are the frameworks in place. That's the approach that we've adopted. I'm not going to go through that. The tripartite free trade area. That was the first bash at it. And then the continental FTA. Well, we have now deposited our instrument of ratification in South Africa. There's just a few countries that need to ratify now, and then it will enter into force and it will start to kick in. It's expected before the end of the year, so we just have to watch that that space. I said something about the Brexit a little while ago. You know, we don't know what's going to happen on the 29th of March. I don't think that anyone in Britain can actually say either exactly what's going to happen. But there is a possibility, more than a possibility maybe, that Britain will, once again, crash out of the EU without an agreement. If that happens, what will happen is that Britain will revert to the WTO's trade regime at the time of the Uruguay round. Now, that means that for things like auto products, we will start paying duties on March the 30th. On fruit, on wine, we will start paying duties if we don't have a corresponding agreement with the British. So we've been working at this thing. We've already got a fairly generous outcome on the tariff rate quotas on agricultural products. I said there were just two outstanding issues. We're waiting for a response from them. And then we want to finish this thing. And then they'll basically roll over the EPA, by and large. But we have to just deal with how are we going to treat the rules of origin, particularly the rules of origin as they apply to products that come from the EU, the rest of the EU. So if Britain leaves, then it's not the problem between us and Britain. A motor component from them and a motor component from us counts under the rules of origin, either to enter there or to enter here. But what about products from the EU? They don't have an agreement with the EU. So we have to fit that in. And then there's a question of recognition of existing SPS certificates. So some companies paid some money for it. How long is that going to be recognized for? Of course, we want it to be as long as possible. We're trying to find a formula to finish that. Let me just say to the committee that this is rush, 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 rush. When we're finished, we're going to bring something in. We want to please ratify. I've been saying to the British, my clock is not ticking down to March the 29th. It's much shorter than that. So we've been saying to them that that really in the next few days we need to finish this thing. So let's hope that happens. And then just on industrialization, I'm not going to go through much of this. Just to say that we've been saying as we prepare the next IPAP, we're not going to go into what we would call lamentations. We were there, I suppose, in a way. We said we've achieved successes, but we've got administered prices as a problem. We've got too little respect for the procurement legislation. So now we have to move out of that into actual proposals. Already we've got some on procurement and localization. I already mentioned some of those. I mentioned what on the African and technical infrastructure. These are all the headings in terms of which we will develop proposals in the next IPAP. As I said, it will go into the range of on, let's say, electricity pricing. What proposals are we going to make? So electricity pricing, which is going to have to take account of the financial circumstances of Eskom and the restructuring of Eskom and all that, how are we going to make sure that we are able to you know, maybe through some or other arrangement with Eskom, ensure that manufacturing and particularly small township and rural economy, black industrialists, and also other important manufacturers are not adversely affected. That's a kind of ongoing engagement. On SEZs and townships and rural economy, I think there's an appetite for a more dynamic approach to that. You know, we as a national department, I think, has had over the license and get on with it. But now it's going to be a bit more, how do we actually maybe even identify the best of them and give something more significant to the best of them. And those things. Then on a fourth industrial revolution, an appropriate policy and regulatory framework, critically important issues in that regard. Then on the sectors, I'm not going to go through that.
Yeah.
A lot of proposals. Investment facilitation. This is an issue here. We've got another investment conference coming. But let me just say we have an agreement with the World Bank. You know, on the ease of doing business, we ranked 82nd on the list. The target is to become 50th over the next 3 years. And for that, we go to the World Bank and say, well, how do you rate us? So one of the indicators is startup of a business. Now, I told you already you can register online, but that's not the end of the story. Because if you want to start a business, you've got to get premises. You've got to get an electricity connection. You've got to get some other permit maybe. And this is also work at municipal level. And I can say that the World Bank also takes Johannesburg as a sort of proxy. And there's some issues there which you want to share with the city of Johannesburg. Because some of the permits and things like that there are the things that take time. So we want to work in a constructive way with them and to try to, on the basis of concrete work, unblock and reduce a number of those things. There'll be an investment council established in 2019. Then here are some of the, it's slightly outdated because it's got Atlantis and Nkomazi there. They've already been proclaimed, but these are proposed new SEZs. Let me stop there. I'll try to go as quickly as I can. And that's a bit of an overview, but I think it does address many of the points that were raised in the SONA. And as far as the budget's concerned, well, if the budget has allocated us money, maybe we could have done with more, but we know that things are tight and at least we have some resources to play with. But let me also say as well that I think that the lesson from the interaction with the Black Industry is important. There are about 13 possible levers that have been identified in the National Industrial Policy Framework as part of the industrial policy. We have to ensure that all of them work, not just that we have money and incentives that can compensate for the non-working of some of the other ones. That thing doesn't work. We need to ensure that all of them work, and I think that's the piece of work that we are looking to in the next IPAN. Thanks very much. Let me stop here.
No, thank you very much, Minister, for that overview. And if you just bear with us for a couple of minutes. You will recall that we need to adopt our agenda. All right. We do have our six people present now. And we had started work, as we were, according to the rules, entitled and encouraged to do with four people, which we did initially. But no, we could not adopt the agenda. So please, will someone propose the adoption of the agenda? Yes, Honourable Khadebe.
Yeah, I propose the adoption of the agenda.
Thank you. And seconded by?
Yes, Honourable
Mantash.
I rise to second, Chair.
Thank you very much. And members, I'm sure you would appreciate that we would agree that the information regarding the apologies can be maintained as is. Is that right? We have been briefed on that. Thank you. We can then, unless Minister Yood wanted to continue, but I think this does offer us a very good opportunity to now engage either through comments, clarifications, but of course also questions. And because we do have the time, I would nevertheless like to ask members to try and stick, let's have a couple of rounds, And let's try and stick within the 4 minute maximum period, 3 to 4 minutes. Honourable MacPherson is the first hand I see, and followed by the Honourable Kadebe, the Honourable Kachalia, and the Honourable Flanguini. In that order, thank you. Over to you, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you. I'm glad we have a bit of time because this may be our last opportunity to interact with each other, one of us or both of us, depending on what happens after the elections. But, Minister, for 4 years, I think that really we've missed the boat of opportunity. And, in fact, I'd probably extend that to 10 years. Because at least for the 4 years that I've been in Parliament, the words headwinds have continuously been used as reasons to why we cannot grow economically. We've now replaced that with the word downward risk, although I did see the word headwind reappeared a few days later. And this is not in consistency with what the President promised in his sona last year, that we would grow 3% GDP. In fact, we are nowhere near that and unlikely to get anywhere near that until 2021-2022. And what concerns me is that our African partners continue to grow, albeit at times at a low base. We are no longer the largest economy in Africa. We're the third largest economy in Africa. And I think that some of the reasons this exists is not because of headwinds or downward risks. It's because of what our partners have been telling us for a number of years. Policy uncertainty. Eskom's continued threat to our economy through blackouts. And so I appreciate that there's a lot of work that gets done by the DTR, but I think that a lot of the real threats and the real opportunities to boost growth continue to be papered over with words like downward risks and headwinds. And there seems to be a disconnect when it comes to industrialization between what the DTI wants and what the government actually does. And that continues to find itself in localization and local procurement. I think that the best example of that has to be the Transnet procurement, where the DTI continuously said that this is the requirements for localization, and yet Transnet and public enterprises went and did their own thing. And the hands of this department were continued to be tied behind its back. But it didn't come as a surprise because it was brought up in the media, it was brought up in this committee. And I raised with you sharply, well, what are the discussions around the cabinet table when other departments continue to flout the regulations that you set in place, that you gazette as the minister? What banging on the table is being done to force them to do what you instruct them to do through legislation and regulation? Another example of that has to be the disconnect that has taken place between Saldana, Atlantis, IDZs, and the way some of the other IDZs, specifically Richards Bay and Kucha, are treated. The former Minister of Energy granted Richards Bay and Kucha gas, but not Saldana. Saldana and Atlantis asked to be IDZs for oil and gas as well as steel manufacturing, and yet it doesn't happen. So that's why I find it disingenuous when the President says, you know, gas is coming to Saldana, when they've been asking to be designated as such for years. Not saying, well, we're going to wait 10 years. They're ready now for it. And in fact, they've been plowing through with the EIAs so that they can do so. Again, where's the banging around the cabinet table instructing your colleagues to do what they are paid to do? Then I want to touch on Brexit, because I'm sure that the chair is going to wave me down in a moment. The big concern that I have over Brexit is not what South Africa's ability is to negotiate a rollover of the EPA, but it's the domestic politics that are playing out in the UK that in fact may now look to have another second, or to have a second referendum, which would then leave us in what may be no man's land. Where are we between a rollover of the EPA? Are we in fact adhering to the original EPA? And so I really need some clarity from yourself about what is the scenario taking, the scenario planning outside of a full Brexit. And then if you could also expand on what are the other issues on the agenda for post-Brexit. What are those other issues that are going to be negotiated after Brexit?
Thank you, Honourable Macpherson. Honourable Khadebe. After Honourable Mantash. All right. Honourable Khadebe.
Comrade Chair, my patients here next to me have just requested to come after me. So I request Honourable Mantash to start first and then.
Well, actually, we'll go to the Honourable Kachalia next, you see, because he was after you. And then we'll come to your colleagues, right?
Thank you, Chair, and through you, thank you, Minister, for your presentation. Clearly, there are the issues are globally and locally deficits, debt, and trade wars, which impact what's going on here, and that's a mixture of global and local headwinds, if you like. Some of those winds are tornadoes of our own making, I'd submit. It's not just about policy uncertainty. It's also about, I would say, the robustness of policy. Now, you spoke about, in terms of policy, about more robust measures in terms of localization. And I think that, as far as I see, that involves the state leading economic development and self-sufficiency, and is predicated on the creation of an internal market. As you yourself say, our internal market is not sizable enough. But more than that, it's a segue to nationalization, subsidization of vital industries. Now on that, what about sugar and chicken, which some may argue could be vital industries? There have been significant failures in that area. We've got chicken, we've got 50 tons per week arriving from Brazil in containers at our ports, which are not being able to be dealt with efficiently. We have, in terms of sugar, we've had delayed tariff implementation, which hasn't helped the industry. So even with the best of efforts, in an area which I would argue, yes, in terms of fair play and leveling the playing fields, is an area of required focus, we haven't actually got traction. Then that leads to more. It leads to increased taxation and to highly protectionist policies of the kind, if you think historically, that were championed by Perón in Argentina, Vargas in Brazil. Even fascist Italy and the Soviet Union championed those policies in the past. In Latin America, there's been, over a long period of time, no particular measure of success in this area, yet we proceed headlong into this. Yes, there may be some short-term gains, as you've pointed out, but the long-term distortions contribute to the global decline that you yourself spoke about and the headwinds that blow in our area. So we're contributing locally to our own demise and internationally to our own demise, and yet we do this. In addition, I think we need to be mindful of BEE and the warnings in localization, and the warnings come from our trading and investment partners, both in that infamous letter that was sent around, if you like, and also from visits which we've had in this very room, and not this very room, into this very committee over time, which have warned us about what they view as impediments to investment. And we have not been particularly mindful of that. This will lead, as it does, as it has, to tit for tat internationally, and we will be sorrier for it. Yes, I'd like to laud to say yes, I think the industrial parks initiatives are good, and the jury's out on the SEZs in terms of spread and cost, and the role of China, I think, needs watching there. Now, you tout regional integration as a panacea. It's a good thing. It's been very tardy, I might add, and we're trying to fix this. Let me leave it there. I think that's enough. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia. Yes, let me just look at my list next. Honourable Montash.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for giving me this opportunity, although I arrived late in the committee, and I apologize about that. Chair, I rise to applaud the work done by this department and the progress they've shown us over this term. And we acknowledge the challenges that we have encountered. And our experience has taught us that your challenges have been mostly facilitated by the silos in which the other departments remain in, and not wanting to be a seamless government that considers the legislation enacted by other departments so that we can all go into the same direction. I'll talk about localization, Chair, because should other departments have, you know, come to the part on localization, we shouldn't be where we are today. When you look at what Transnet has done in not buying our local products and decided to buy from outside. Chair, I also applaud them on the clean audit that they've brought to the department in almost all of their entities. Chairperson, I have a sore point here, the triple BEE, which the DA is an enemy of. And all South Africans must see this organization for the hypocrites they are, because they behave as if they care about black people. And they say they want to build a South Africa, one South Africa. How can they build one South Africa when people are unequal? Well, because if you fight triple BEE, you're saying blacks must stay where they are. It's fine. The country must go on. That's hypocritic. Chair, my passion, industrial parks. We applaud progress, Chairperson, and the department, and we've seen the number of jobs created in all industrial parks and SEZs. Chair, but we thought that would be a second round because some of them need support so that we can invite more investments into the industrial parks, which could assist us in the so much needed jobs. We wish there could be a second round. I thought Minister had promised us at some point, but when is that second round coming? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Montash. Honourable Flanguini.
Thanks very much, Chair. And Honourable Montash, I have taken my last part of the triple BEE because in the presentation on page 52, there's a line that reads more entities willing to be triple BEE compliant. And we shouldn't... I still don't understand why we are putting that line like that, Honourable Minister. We need to enforce them because it's a policy. We need to enforce them. It's not because they want to or not want to. And the moment we play that with them, you know, we give them leverage to say I don't need to do it. So it should be totally enforceable, because there is a policy of the day that seeks to equalize the economy and give each of and everyone equal opportunities. So we shouldn't play it like that. Then I on your plans, Minister, or your party's plans. I don't want to be like a prophet of doom today. We are hopefully after May, some of them will scrap it when we come back as government of the day. Because we can't have, we still are importing too many things. We still, the other day you said even the chicken that we eat here in Parliament, everything that, you know, the toilet papers, everything. So we need to really diversify and truly implement our policies and not just put it on paper. And it's clear and it's true what Honorable Mantashe is saying. There are still some departments that live and work in silos, and you don't have departments that work together in these policies. So I think hopefully we'll get it right, and we'll hold you to account on some of these nice plans that you have and you came and read for us today. And hopefully some of your comrades, and you must warn them, the ones that are putting their hand in the cookie jar, that they are sabotaging the country, and will come for them if this, because this is a lot of money that we seek to invest in these industries, and we're not going to allow a situation where people are going to go and do corruption in all of these industries, because we need to develop our black industrialists, and if they're going to stand in our way in doing that, we will come for them. So they need to be warned that we will enforce and let this parliament pass that there must be a jail sentence. So I will hold you to account. There's nothing that we can say at this stage. We'll just have to see on the plans that you came and said to us today, and to hold you account still after May when we have increased in parliament. We'll be having more seats. DA is declining.
Thank you, Honourable Tlangwini. Honourable Tiako.
Thanks, Chair. And Honourable Minister, welcome the report. When you started with the issue of jobs created by the department on the fourth quarter, which is around 149,000 around there. And what I wanted to check out of this figure, the jobs itself are sustainable, so that we say we have created jobs, because you can't say 149 meaning temporary jobs or part-time jobs, and then after that 149 it was about 50,000. So I wanted to check on that one specifically to say, when we say we are creating jobs, is it these jobs sustainable, or is just it's a short-term basis? The issue of contract, when you speak about slide where there are Transnet, and we see on the commissions that the president are busy on TV every day. The intervention that is there, what I want to check is that the DTI itself, are they any other contracts that were done that are affected by the commission itself currently as we speak? Because we don't want the situation where you act because the commission, somebody revealed information on the commission. You need to put system in place as yourself, so that when the people confess there, you already are on board. Not that you are taken by surprise by commissions, then now you start behaving like you want to arrest people, because the process itself as it is, they confess, they act. So we want to check if our department, is there any contract that is affected by the State Capture Commission on the processes that are happening there, and what intervention are you going to put in place so that while that process is unfolding, we know that the department has done something in the process. The issue of localization, as they're saying, we are having the same concern, all of us, to say, if you have policies in place and they are not applying it, what measures have you taken yourself as a department to address that issue of people who decide to do their own thing while there are policies in place? And it affects our own people in here. The issue of imports and the people that are not benefiting, I think some of the members have outlined, and also the WIP will try and address some of the issues that I'm going to leave behind. Fourth industrialization is happening. And I'm happy because some of the successes that we're talking about here, there, as copyright amendment here, when we were adopting that thing, we knew, we made exceptions that we also prepare for the future. The concern is maybe we'll raise it when we deal with those treaties. So that's where maybe, because if we say you are acknowledging that the fourth industrialization is here and we need to do something. But that issue will only go into detail maybe when we deal with the treaties that are outstanding that needs to be ratified by the department, which is an outstanding issue, which is, I think, it's a backlog to us, then, Chair. Thanks so much.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Tiako. Just to conclude then, Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, thanks for this opportunity. I'll also concur with my colleagues that we appreciate the input made by the Minister, because it speaks directly to the State of the Nation address plus the budget. But Chair, I'll start with the issue of the budget. When the Minister delivered the budget last week, he was very explicit when he said that the South African economy is small, but it is open. It means that it is affected by all the vulgarities which is happening in the entire world. So it is correct that the presentation is premised on the fact that there are certain headwinds which are outside our control, which are there, which is a fact, which must be affected. I'll make a very simple example, Chair. On the issue of Brexit, because of that uncertainty which is happening in the UK, there are certain plants which are being closed down, car manufacturing plants, which are being closed down because of uncertainty. Why is it possible? Because the economy of UK is open to what happened. So whatever happens inside the outside wind, they just come in very quickly. So will not be an exception here. So we are correct that we are affected. If who our people who take our products is the EU. It is China. So if those economies are slowing down in the U.S., we are bound to be affected with what we are going to be exporting. So I think, Minister, you are still correct there. But what you also omitted here today, Chair, is the issue of what the President said during SONA. He said each and every penny which has been taken away from the fiscus or from the cookie jar, that money must be, not only people must be jailed, the money must be recovered. Because if we can recover that money, Chair, that investment drive which the President is driving actually might not even be needed. If you can look at the huge volume of the money which has been fleeced off, actually we can actually stand on our own. So as the DTI is responsible for policy, let's say on localization, and the other departments are not complying with that, what measures did you put in place to force them to comply so that we don't have these leakages we're having? Because if you can look at the trends, Chair, actually it's very pathetic, the amount of money which we lost. So the issue here is that what did the department do to ensure that we recover that? As Honourable Decker said, that we don't have to wait for the Commission of Inquiry. There are certain acts which were committed which were wrong, of which the President emphasized that they must be recovered. What are you putting in place with your colleagues in the Cabinet, Chair? And then, Comrade Chairperson, on the issue of the broad-based black economic empowerment, It's also very important. I like what on the slide number 52 at the bottom there. Apart from broad-based black economic empowerment, does this set aside, which are put by Professional Procurement Policy Framework Act, which says that if there's a tender from government, in particular if it's excess of 30 million rand, 30% must benefit the local entrepreneurs. I don't see that coming out. That's why last year I asked the president the question in the House, what is this attitude? He confirmed that it's part of the policy. And then as we interact with our counterparts, how to ensure that that policy is complied with? Because when you go down there, even at the municipal level, whatever we come from, that policy framework is not complied with. So what can be done to help? Because if you have, you implement those 30% that set aside, you can help a lot with local economic development because you will ensure that money remains in the locality where this thing is concerned. Chairperson, the other issue is the issue of the special economic zones. Now, the first special economic zone which was designated in China was Shenzhen. When the former president of China, Deng Xiaoping, designated the first economic zone. Now, but when you look, last year when they were celebrating 40 years of Dengism, there's something which they highlighted about Shenzhen, that city has got a population of about 12 million people, but its GDP is more than $652 billion. It's really bigger than us. What is Ethiopia doing to ensure that we achieve a similar success on our special economic zones here? No, I have a special economic zone in Maluti, but I don't feel the way I felt when I went to China. I don't feel that dynamism, that you job which is supposed to come in. I'll come in the second bunch. Thank you.
Before members get very enthusiastic, everyone, and I think it's the point that the Honourable Macpherson made, we just haven't been able to engage earlier. I have not spoken and I will not because, frankly, we run out of time totally. We still have sugar coming in and they're coming in at 12:55. We still have to do the treaties. So there won't be a second bite today. There cannot be, because we'll run right out of time. Some of you had 5.5 minutes, and that was just too long. So I won't take that, if you don't mind, Honourable Macpherson, because I want the department to respond at this time. To what ruling? Sorry, be specific. What ruling?
Well, I mean, you've just ruled that there's going to be no second round. We asked the questions the first round in the belief that there was a second round. This is the last time that we are having this discussion before this parliament rises. There are many critical issues that I still need to raise, bring to the minister's attention so that they can be handed over to the sixth administration. I'm sure there's other colleagues. And if we need to sit into the house, then so be it. But I mean, this is a critical discussion that we're having.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I asked for 3 minutes. And at the outside, shifting to 4. But you yourself, and you weren't the only one, took more than 5 minutes. So, you know, if we're going to talk about positions and so on, the reality is, on the basis of 3 minutes, there may have been an opportunity. There isn't at the moment. However, what you may do, and that is all of you, because there isn't anyone here that doesn't want to re-engage, please put them in writing, and they will be sent to the department. Thank you, Minister, and your team.
No, thanks very much, Chair. I will ask the team to answer one or two questions, but let me just take them as they came. I think that the question that was raised by the Honourable Macpherson, taken up a bit by one or two others about lack of coherence and actions taking place elsewhere in government and that kind of stuff, is what we've been saying for quite a long time. And I think that in the last 3 or 4 years, it's absolutely correct that we've been saying these things. What's different now is that who's banging the table in cabinet is the man at the top, the man in the ring. That's what's different. So I think that what we've got now is an environment which is asking us in our neck of the woods and everyone else who's involved in any decisions that have an impact to actually come up with actual proposals about putting things right. That's the difference now. So I said even when we come to the next IPAP, that's the work that we will be doing. We won't be just saying that there is a danger now of electricity prices. We'll be making some proposals, and I think that's where we want to go. I think it was, you know, we're talking about 2019. I don't think we can avoid saying that 2019 there are things happening on the world scale that will impact on us. I'm not saying that means we're not going to do anything or can't do anything. I think that actually what I was trying to say about the investment is we buck the trend there. We can buck the trend on a few other things. Some of the things that the Honourable McPherson said were not wrong. We need to get consequential follow-through of decisions that we take. I mean, the enforcement of localization designations is not entirely the DTI, because we do the work and the proposal, then it goes to Treasury and it becomes a practice note in Treasury. Once it's turned into a practice note by Treasury, it's not an option any longer, it's an instruction. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we've seen that the, you know, we're not necessarily the body that that can say to everybody that this is what's happened. It becomes a matter of governance and all of that. And I said we've been engaging the Auditor General for some years now. And now I think we got to the point where the Auditor General will now be making findings on non-compliance with applicable legislation, and the new Audit Act will make non-implementation much more of a difficult thing for those that don't. I think we want to increase and improve consequence management. That's actually what we said in the Job Summit, by the way. That's a critical area there. But I can't help but say that if there's lack of cohesion and coherence within government, I'm not so sure about the shadow DTI team, the two gentlemen that are sitting there, because I'm not quite sure that they were saying the same things on some of these issues. I'm not quite sure what the Honourable Kachalia was saying on the sugar tariff, because on the one hand he seemed to be saying we were too slow to implement the sugar tariff, which was a substantial increase in the tariff, and on the other hand he was saying we mustn't increase tariffs because, you know, they take us into all these cases in Latin America. So I don't know what he's actually saying. Well, I mean, I think the process by which we take tariffs decisions in South Africa is that an industry player approaches ITAC. ITAC makes a recommendation after hearing all the evidence and allowing people the due opportunity. I can tell you that when the sugar tariff came to me, it didn't take very long for me to sign it off. I didn't hold it up. I never held it up. That I can tell you that. Because we recognize the importance of that and the importance of responding to the threats to jobs in the sugar industry. And I was telling the sugar team back here about the pushback and the uphill that we have within SACU on this matter, SACU on this matter, and the battles that we have to fight to preserve our you know, the right to intervene like that. Now, on poultry, poultry is like sugar, an industry that doesn't operate worldwide. The world trade in sugar and poultry is not, according to textbook, free market. What we've got is we have surplus production of brown meat in the developed world, which has got two things they can do with it. They can turn it into dog food, or they can sell it to countries like us. And they get more by doing the latter. And I can tell you, I sat through the meeting with the EU on the EPA a couple of weeks. Last week, was it? Last week. What do you think the big issue was? They want us to open up and remove the safeguard on poultry. That's what it is. The pressure's enormous from everybody and his dog. To stay in AGOA, we had to make a concession to them. And I think that We have taken all of the tariff decisions we have taken on the basis of, first of all, exploring the evidence. Secondly, is it compatible with WTO rules? And if the evidence comes up, we've taken a decision in favour of local industries. There's no presumption about whether the tariff must go up or down. And that has meant that, unlike in the past, maybe, where the presumption was no tariff could ever go up, that has meant we've raised some. And I think we don't apologise for that. But of course, those are not the only tools that we've got in our toolbox. We need to use others as well. But I can tell you that, that may not be very long, but as long as, in this administration, what we've been trying to do is to take decisions in favour of productive sectors and jobs in our country, wherever we can. And I think that, a greater clarity and understanding about the environment out there in which these decisions are taken is very important, because international trade is not when you sit around the table and you say we all want to be nice and develop each other's economies. Not like that. It's actually dog-eat-dog. And if you don't understand it like that, I don't know what world you live in. Let me then just say quickly on localization. I think we make no apology for the fact that we are deploying the tools, the policy tool of localization. No apology. I'm not quite sure what the Honourable Kachalia was saying about localization, because I think coming from Honourable McPherson, it was that we weren't applying it properly and that there were too many gaps and too many misuses, which I agree with. We agree with. The rail, where the rail tariff localization, the rail localization was applied, it led to investments and it led to job creation. And it was applied in a number of cases. So we had, let me just say, one international company that told me, I met them, the execs in America, General Electric. They said they've never manufactured a locomotive outside of the United States. The first time they did it was to qualify for our rail program, our locomotive manufacturing program. Then that became the model for India later on. So now they manufacture locomotives elsewhere in the world. And I think that's a good thing, because when they came here, and I saw them some years ago, they were quite happy with what they got. Now later on, this thing became a problem. Now my view, which I've argued, and which we want to push, is not just that we must get the money back, but I don't know how many times we're going to buy 1,064 locomotives and 3,000 wagons. Those contracts that were wrongly given for imports, they need to be cancelled and reissued according to the localization. That's what they need to do. That's our view. That's what we're pushing for. And so we're very happy now that there are processes going on. It's not for me to intervene in all of these commissions of inquiry or anything like that, but where they find their things that have been done wrong, they must be put right, so that we reclaim the policy tools. And localization is an area where we have the biggest hypocrisy, the biggest hypocrisy. Those that preach the most about not having it have got it themselves. Sometimes it's not applied at national level, it's at sub-national level. But believe me, it's there. And if you don't believe me, just go and see what the Buy America Act says about railway procurements by the U.S. It says 100% manufactured and mined in the U.S. That's what it says. Now, it's much more than ours. So I think that we need to understand that's the world we're living in. And let me then just say on the question that was raised about the Brexit, some of the scenarios, I mean, this is the point, I think, about Brexit, is there many scenarios. We don't know what's going to happen. Are they going to delay it? Is the deal, the withdrawal agreement, going to get through with some modifications? Is there going to be no agreement in place? And I think if is there going to be a referendum? Is there going to be an extension of the withdrawal process? We don't know which one of those is going to happen in the next little while. Every single one of those, except the crash out, the leaving on March the 29th with no agreement, would probably involve an extension of the status quo. In other words, the EPA would continue to apply in the UK. So if the withdrawal agreement came in, the EPA would continue to apply until the end of 2020, by which time, I mean, if they have it, they will have some agreement with the EU. If the if that agreement were to be a customs union or something like that, then that would apply. The EPA would continue to apply. If there's another referendum, presumably they would not leave until that referendum has reached its decision. The status quo would apply. But if they do leave on the 29th of March, and even our interlocutors in Britain, who support, by and large, support Prime Minister May's deal, they tell us, don't count on it. You better count on the other one as a possibility. So what we've got in place is, if you like, a backstop. And that's the word they use. We've got a backstop. That's what it is. That comes into force. And we better have that backstop in place. If we have this agreement in place and then Theresa May's deal comes through, then it will apply at the end of 2020 if they don't reach an agreement. But I think that's really what it amounts to. Now, you know, if there are all sorts of other repercussions, and they might affect the auto industry, I was saying already, in Europe. What effect it has on the South African auto industry is like small beer compared to what it might have on the European auto industry. So, you know, what waves and ripples is that going to put through the world auto industry? I think we need to be aware that that's where we're at. And, of course, we are aware and concerned at what could happen with Eskom. But the point is that there is a directive on putting it right, not just saying, sell it off or do whatever, let it go, you know. It's actually, we got the responsibility, well, the man in the ring, the president, has got the responsibility of putting it right, and he's banging on the table to get these things done. That's why I think that when we come back again, we aren't going to come back with just headwinds. We're going to come back and say, this is how we deal with the headwinds. That's what I think is going to be said there. Then let me say on the, where were we now? On the BEE, enforcement of fronting, on the BEE. The way BEE works, BEE law was work, is that it's not a law that says you have to be BEE compliant. It says if you come to government, you want a license, you want a tender, or you want a regulatory benefit, then government departments, now not as far as reasonably possible, government departments must set a level of BEE recognition in return for whatever you're going to get from government. That's what we say. So that's what we want to achieve. Now, we want entities to become BEE compliant. We don't want to have a whole lot of people who are trying to hold us ransom and things like that and say, we're not going to provide this or that's necessary and we'll hold back. We want them to become more BEE compliant, and I think that's what we're saying. But there is something else that came in the 2013 Act, and that is fronting legislation. We've got a lot of complaints in those sectors that are going to the BEE commissioner. And fronting is becoming much more complex now. And let me tell you one of the forms of fronting that we're trying to combat. We are hearing entities will go to companies and they will say, no, you mustn't just follow these codes. These are minimalist. We're going to go maximalist. We want to have 51% ownership. You give us 51% ownership and you can have the deal. Then there is an industry now called the BEE, not verification, but BEE facilitation or advisors. And they go around and they'll say, psst, you don't have to, those people don't want anything other than dividends. They don't want to be on your boards. They don't want to be in your management. You don't have to do any supplier development or skills development. Just give us a dividend flow. That is fronting. That is non-compliance with the law, and that we're not going to put up with. Apart from being corruption, by the way, outright corruption, because sometimes you'll tell people, work with me and mine on that. So we're going to toughen up on all of this, because I think that the point about corruption, state capture and everything, all of these policy tools have all been adversely affected.
And as I said earlier on, we can't just compensate them. We can't just call the black industrialists and say, oh, we're not going to buy your stuff, you know, but here's a bit more money from the DTI. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. So I think we want to put a whole lot of other things in place. On the jobs, I think that figure was the total number of jobs that had been created in the fourth quarter last year in the South African economy. It wasn't the DTI. The total number of jobs recorded by Stats South Africa. That's what that was. And then let me just see where we are now. Anything else? What have I missed? The thing I've missed, which I'm going to ask the team to address, is it was in the presentation that we still have a number of industrial parks that we need to roll out phase one over. But there is an intention to move to phase two. I just don't know the time frame, so I'm just going to ask the team to answer on that. But let me also say I'm very pleased to see now that that the Honourable Kachalia says that the industrial parks were a good thing, because his colleagues in the past said that this was wasting money on resurrecting apartheid dinosaurs or something. So I think that. Thank you for coming. You know, as they say, achter ons kom ook in die kraal. Okay, but I don't know. DG, do you want to the question on phase two of the industrial park?
Yes, Honourable Mantashe. Yes, I think we've got positive news on that front. As you know, we have applied for the next round, and we've got the industrial parks to submit their concrete plans for the second phase and so on. And I have been informed that with the new budget allocation coming through, they have been confirmed for about over 300 million has been allocated towards the industrial parks for the second phase of that. So we should see quite a good injection, especially in the new ones as well, Dimbaza, Queen's Industry and others. So they will be covered in the next phase, yeah.
I think, Minister and DG, you did cover the issues that were raised, but I think you heard what I said. Members have a number of other issues they would like to raise, and we will send this along to you and appreciate a full response. Time is against us because we do have these treaties to get through, as well as the sugar issue. So I want to thank you and your team, and do apologize to members that we have not had sufficient time. Right. Just as we move to the other, I'm not sure who is addressing the treaties per se. Right. Will you be staying, DG? I know that you are leaving, Minister. Yes, thank you. So, members, we're going to move on immediately now to the treaties, briefing on and consideration of the accession to ratification of the following treaties. Right, we've got them down here, and then there would simply be a briefing on the Marrakesh, giving us an idea as to where we are. So let us just see who we have here in front of us here, looking at the treaties. That's sugar. Yeah, there's the treaties. That's the director. Who's the chief director here? Sharon Osman. Is that right? Shireen. Is it S-H-A-R? Industrial Development. What is your name then? Okay, just where is the lady's name here? I don't know where her name is. No, this is not Miss Shindri. Yeah. Oh, there we are. No. It's Miss, is it Mrs. Mabirimisa? Right, okay. Now, I was being shown some green thing which I could hardly pronounce. I certainly know who Ms. Mashendri is. Of course I do, Padiachi.
We have a director legal service support in the CCRD, and also a deputy director of IP policy at the DTI, Ms. Mahendra. Can you go straight ahead, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will go ahead with the presentation, starting with really the purpose of being here today, which is to seek approval to accede to the World Intellectual Property Organization treaties, mainly on copyright law. We are presenting today the Beijing Treaty on Audiovisual Performance, the WIPO Performance and Phonograms Treaty, and the WIPO Copyright Treaty. We'll also brief the House on the progress made with the Marrakesh Treaty to date. And that is just our table of contents. And then...
You have an idea of the time you have, so that members have got the opportunity to engage on them. We need to have completed with this item by 12:55. All right? So clearly we need time to engage as well on the matter. So effectively you've probably got about 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the outset.
Thank you, Chair. I will not go through all of the slides, but just starting with the background, it actually takes us back to the Berne Convention of 1886, which South Africa became a member of in October 1928. Then we had our performers and the Copyright Act in 1967 and 1978, respectively. Then after that, there was the TRIPS Agreement, the Trade-Related Aspect of Intellectual Property Agreement from the WTO side, which South Africa is also a member of. It also impacts on copyright-related issues. It brings in the principles of most favored nation, and obviously refers a lot to substantive provisions of the Berne Convention on Copyright. Then in 98, concerns were already rising and being raised in South Africa regarding our artists dying as paupers. The Department of Arts and Culture then introduced the Music Industry Task Team. Then in 2002, we saw the reintroduction of needle time laws in South Africa. I'll jump some of the really steps just in the interest of time. But most importantly, the Copyright Review Commission and its report in 2010, which assessed issues of collecting societies, the model of distribution for royalties to musicians and composers of music. And in 2013, the DTI published a draft national IP policy, which included statements regarding copyright amendment. In 2014, there was a regulatory impact assessment study that was done on the IP policy, which also pronounced a lot on matters relating to the treaties, as we are sitting on them today. And in 2018, which followed the introduction of the Performance Protection Amendment Bill and the Copyright Amendment Bill in Parliament, in 2018 we started in earnest the process really to prepare South Africa to accede to the treaties as stated above. And in this process there was a lot of consultations that were done within the cabinet subcommittees, the Department of Arts and Culture. We worked with them closely, considering their interest in copyright matters and performance matters. Then on the need to review, really this just speaks to the issues that the Copyright Amendment Bill deals with, and also the Performance Protection Amendment Bill. I will not go through them in detail, but just to say, really, the main issues were addressing poor governance of collecting societies, the issue of agreements with foreign collecting societies,
introducing new rights, which is some of the rights brought on by the treaties that we are presenting today, including the right of communication to the public.
Before I get confused moving forward, I want to understand the need to review CAB because we are done with these processes and the PPA. So I need to understand because maybe I'll be more confused or more understood. They need to summarize this thing. Because once you say they need to review, what is the meaning of this presentation?
I think the thing is on here, as I understood it, it was giving us the background as at that particular time. Because you see one of the blocks here that I see at the bottom indicates that they've gone through cabinet. And I know they went through cabinet, I think it was December last year. So let us, in the interests of time, move beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And moving on to just the implementation with regards to the treaties and the process that we undertook as a department. The first step was to actually seek legal opinions from our sister departments, Department of Justice and the Department of International Relations, just for them to assist in pronouncing on the alignment with our domestic laws, international law, and obviously South Africa's international obligations. That was done, and the treaties were supported. Then the President's minute was signed. We sought cabinet approval, went through the committees, and cabinet approved. And the other two are really just on today and the way forward. These slides were basically just going to give members an opportunity in what came out from the RIA assessments, but I will not go through them in detail. Then on the legal status of the WIPO treaties, just as a background, the Beijing Treaty deals with the intellectual property rights of performers in audiovisual performances. And the WPPT addresses two kinds of beneficiaries, which is mainly your performers, actors, singers, musicians, but also producers of phonograms. The WCT, it deals with the protection of authors in literary and artistic works and really is aligned with the Berne Convention. Okay, on the status of each of the treaties, the Beijing Treaty was adopted on 24 June 2012. And our members should note that it is not yet in force. The WPPT is already in force, including the WCT. Then with regards to signatures and accession, this is an issue that through the legal opinions from DECO and DOJ, we were actually cautioned to actually state the fact that with the WPPT and the WCT, the two were actually signed by South Africa when they were adopted by WIPO. This was in December 1997. Normally, if South Africa or any country has signed, the normal way to proceed would be to ratify the treaties in question. But in our case, because we couldn't confirm that there was authorization given to actually sign those treaties, we have been advised to proceed by way of accession, which essentially has the same effect of binding South Africa to the treaties as ratification would do. And the Beijing Treaty, so far, 24 out of 191 members have ratified. They need 30, at least, member states before it comes into force. And with that, it brings in the question of what would be the impact of acceding to it before it actually comes into force. And with that one, we have been advised that the validity of the provisions that we currently have in our amendment bills is not dependent on whether the treaty is in force or not, but rather in terms of whether the process was followed in terms of our constitution. So if it happens that the bills become law before the treaty itself comes into force, then as South Africa, we will not be impacted by that. We continue to enforce our domestic law as it is. And here it's just the notable provisions of the treaties. And it's quite a lot of information, and I think in summary, I would just like to highlight that the Beijing Treaty brings with it rights such as reproduction rights, distribution, rental, and the rights of making available. This is with regards to performances fixed in audiovisual fixations. And with regards to your live performances, it introduces three rights, which is the right of broadcasting, communication to the public, and the right of fixation. Then I will move to the WPPT and just really summarize the rights that it brings in as well. And in here we see economic rights of reproduction, distribution, rental, and making available. And this is mainly for performers on their fixed performances. And then on with producers of phonograms, then they get the same rights. And moving on to the WCT and the rights that it brings in.
Don't go so fast that you miss some of the critical issues.
Okay.
I doubt if any member sitting here knows that. The critical issues that this outlines here, some of them are very, very important. I mean, the whole issue of circumvention of technological protection measures, etc., the exclusive right, and, you know, the terms of the national treatment. Some of them are particularly important, but you would know that better than us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just to conclude on the rights that the WCT brings in, then we can go back and just highlight a few areas for each treaty. The WCT brings with it additional rights to those already in the Berne Convention. Members will recall that the Berne brought with it the right of translation, adaptation, reciting, performing, broadcasting, and so forth. But with the WCT, we see now three additional rights, which is the right of distribution, the right of rental, and a broader right of communication to the public. Okay. And on the Beijing Treaty, some of the notable areas really. Obviously, overall, it's a recognition of rights in the digital environment. And another thing is basically the extension of rights in fixed and unfixed performances, which is the rights that I've already alluded to. But then most importantly is the moral rights, which is really the right to claim to be identified as the performer and the right to actually object to any distortion, mutilation, or modification of your work. Okay. And then another one that is worth mentioning is the circumvention of technological protection measures. And in here, contracting parties are required to put in place adequate measures to actually protect and give remedies in instances where there is deliberate alteration or removal of electronic rights management information. This information will normally assist right holders with things like tracking how their work has been used for purposes of then collecting royalties on it and so forth. Then the issue of national treatment as a principle that the treaties, almost all the treaties actually adopt this principle. It's basically that we must treat nationals of other countries in the same manner that we treat South Africans when it comes to these rights. And all of these treaties are actually non-self-executing treaties. And once Parliament has actually approved accession to them, they do not automatically become part of our law. They become part of our law through incorporation in our domestic laws. Thank you, Chair. And then the term of protection, as we know, is 50 years, which is, again, emphasized in all of these treaties. Okay. And with the WPPT, the rights, we've already spoken to them, but there's also the issue of equitable remuneration. So in certain instances, where phonograms, for instance, are used directly or indirectly or published for commercial purposes, then the right owner should be given that equitable remuneration. I think we call it royalties in South Africa mainly. Okay. Some I'm not going to repeat because I've already stated them as above. Okay, and then that's the WCT, and really that just that emphasis. There's actually been questions that by acceding to the WCT, there might be, you know, a misalignment with our commitments rather to the Berne Convention already, and compliance with Berne is actually required when you accede to the WCT. Article 1 emphasizes on that. And, okay, some of these issues are really just coming up, but obviously with the WCT, we now see the protection of computer programs and original compilation of data or databases. Okay, I've already spoken to most of this. But just that highlights that with regards to the WCT, we cannot make any reservations in terms of the obligations that are in that treaty. And with regards to consistency with domestic and international law, we've already mentioned that DOJ and DECO, from an international point of view, have given the thumbs up that the treaties do comply with the two. And we had to do an alignment proposition with the National Development Plan. Then, okay, the implication part is really just looking at constitutionally, would we need to make amendments should we accede to these treaties? That will not be necessary, but obviously acceding to these treaties enhances intellectual property rights of our authors in their copyright works and so forth. Then implications for vulnerable groups. We're basically looking at the South African creative industry as an industry with a lot of challenges. And obviously acceding to these treaties, it benefits the flow as a result of the increased protection in other countries. In terms of the financial implications, South Africa is already a member of WIPO, and because of that, there's no additional charges for that, but there will be costs, obviously, of participating in the different assemblies that are created in terms of these treaties to support them and to obviously develop them. Okay. Then the issue on the Marrakesh, the update really on where the work is. We, at the same time that we're approaching DECO and DOJ on the other treaties, we also took through the Marrakesh Treaty, as it is crucial and really pertinent to the process that is happening with the Copyright Amendment Bill. Mm-hmm. Members will recall that the treaty really is about facilitating access to published works for persons who are blind, visually impaired, or otherwise print disabled. I think our bill goes a little bit further to include other categories as well. And it requires contracting parties to actually put in place standard limitations and exceptions to copyright rules in order to permit the reproduction, distribution, and making available of published works to the beneficiaries listed above. Thus far, that's really just the outcome of the legal opinions from DECO, starting with DOJ. Their view was that considering where the bill is, you know, the fact that it is not yet finalized, should there be any resistance to it or any provisions relating to the Marrakesh, South Africa would then be bound by its international obligations to the disadvantage of domestic obligations. And on that basis, they recommended that we await finalization of the bill before we can accede to the Marrakesh. And the way forward that we are proposing is obviously to resuscitate this process as soon as the bill is finalized, but we will be guided by the portfolio committee. Okay. And then in conclusion, acceding to the WIPO treaties will ensure that there is access to copyright works, specifically by those that are most vulnerable. And, you know, that our law keeps up with the technological developments, not just where we are today, but moving forward. And protection for rights holders in the digital environment as well. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. I know you were under pressure, but it's a very clear presentation, which I think we can all make use of. Now, members, because we will in due course then be, you know, having to adopt our report, etc., in order to take this to the House, I would like to offer you the opportunity to clarify, and let's leave the Marrakesh out of it for the moment, and purely deal with the first three, which we're looking at the Beijing Treaty, and then we'll be looking at the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, Performances and Phonograms Treaty, and then we're looking at, again, the accession to the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, the Copyright Treaty. All right, those are the three we're going to be clarifying any, you know, questions on, etc. And by show of hands, I'll take your hand for a couple of minutes to engage Honourable Tierko. Is there another hand? No?
Chair, thanks for the presentation. I really understand when you say you must not discuss Marrakesh, but it's critical that we understand the position of the department at this stage, because how do you say to us we must adopt the three and leave the one, while the process itself, it includes everything, what is happening at NCOP now. We finalize the bill, we adopt everything, because why should we favor others while we leave our people that are in need of this thing? The disabled will be left out.
I allowed you just to continue, although the point is I did not say you would not be allowed to engage Marrakesh. We're first going to be dealing with these three. I did not say we will not engage on Marrakesh, and then the department can respond to this, these important issues which you are raising. I would also clarify to members where the bills are as we sit here. Exactly what part of the process are they sitting at? All right. So the first things we're going to do are these three that I've mentioned. Yes, we'll have time for Marrakesh, and that's what I'm seeking to do. So on these first three, are there any, is there any need for a clarification or what, Honourable Tierko?
Thanks, Chair. She spoke about misalignment, which needs to be rectified, isn't it? I don't know. She must just explain more on that part and what is the meaning of it to the rectification. That's why I said all everything, it comes to one. But she must just, if you say it's clarification, I'll just ask that question on that three.
Uh-huh. One clear question. The other point that was made, and I just can't see where it is in the presentation, is that something about a document couldn't be found, but that it amounts to the same thing. So instead of going for ratification, we would go for a session. So just explain that, all right? So you have these two issues on the table. UDG?
So I take it that, as I said, there's no objections or the support for the three treaties moving ahead. And then on the question of the accession, it's really just to be on the very safe side. But because, as I said, because we've already signed up to the treaty, we could just go for ratification. That would be the normal course of events. But because that document in 1997, because the presidential minute could not be obtained by Durco, to be safe, they said, let's just go for accession so that when we adopt it, we will be bound and be part of that treaty. So it's just a legal, let's say, guarantee that we have, that we went from ratification to accession. And so, so that then makes it completely, if we have the endorsement for proceeding with the three treaties, then as I said, where there's a legitimate point by, raised by the Honorable Teko is just on the last minute decision of Department of Justice on how we deal with the Marrakesh Treaty. But I think there is a solution that we maybe discussed informally earlier, which we can come with to deal with Marrakesh.
We're just going to process these three first that we're quite clear on, you see, and then we'll come back to Marrakesh, all right? So, members, if everyone is here, first one we're looking at is them. We do need an agreement here. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the accession to the Beijing Treaty on audiovisual performances, data 26 February 2019. We have by a show of hand who would propose that, yes, the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, having considered the request for approval by Parliament on the accession to the Beijing Treaty on the audiovisual performances, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Right. By just show of hands, do we agree? Honourable Khadebe?
So we approve the agreement.
Second, thank you. Is it seconded by Honourable Mantar?
I second, Chair.
Are there any objections to taking this process forward? No objections noted. So this one then proceeds. We can proceed with the Beijing Treaty. We then take the second one, the report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the accession to the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, Performances and Phonograms Treaty, dated 26 February 2019. The Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, having considered the request for approval by Parliament on the accession to the Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, Performances and Phonograms Treaty, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Can we have someone? By show of hands, Honourable Teko.
I move, Chair, that this is adopted by the committee.
Thank you, Honourable Teoko. Seconded by? Honourable Khadebe, is your hand up?
Yes. I support, Chair.
Thank you. Are there any objections? No objections noted. So this goes ahead. Now we go to the copyright, yeah. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Industry on the accession to the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, Copyright Treaty, dated 26 February 2019. The Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, having considered the request for approval by Parliament on the accession to the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, Copyright Treaty, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Honourable Teko?
Yes, Chair. Can I move that this be adopted by the committee?
Thank you, Honourable Teko. Seconded. Honourable Tlangwini? Can you, on record, please, sorry?
I second it, Chair.
Thank you. Are there any objections? No objections noted. That goes through as well. Now, members, we've got those three out of the way. Now, just to brief you on the Marrakesh in terms of Parliament, first of all. Honourable Khadebe?
Chairperson, before we pass, go to Marrakesh, because what I want to ask is that when will these agreements go into the ATC? When is it expected in the House? And then when it goes into the House, can we debate it as a single thing?
Yeah.
Because it deals with intellectual property. If I can get that explained so that we take a decision.
I think that's a very wise approach. In the past, we've had these similar agreements, and then they've all been broken up. And there's no, I think, substantive reason why that needs to be done. So, Mr. Herman's on record. When will you be placing these on the ATC as a group?
Chair, we will publish it this evening in the ATC, so it should appear tomorrow morning in the all three. With respect to the other matters, it will be a programming issue, so it's out of our hands. It will have to be discussed with you, with the political...
May I suggest, Honourable Khadebe, the whip, that you discuss the matter with Honourable Bengu, yes.
Chair, can we take an in-principle decision that we are going to discuss it as a single debate? Yeah. Can we take that as a principle decision so that when we go for a programming, we know what you'll be requesting on that side?
I think we can request, we can make a proposal in that regard. We can't automatically guarantee that is what Parliament, the Speaker, will agree to, and I think that that's important to keep in mind. So if you wish then, members, we can make an in-principle proposal that this is discussed as one, you know, as one broader issue, and propose that that is taken through to the House. So can we have a seconder of the Chair's proposal? Yes, Honourable Tierko.
Thanks, Chair. I second that we debate it as a one.
Very constructive proposal. Any objections, please? No. Fine. Thank you, members, for that constructive approach, and let's hope this time it is taken through as one. Now, members, with respect to the copyright agreement, because you would have seen, and we are going to just clarify this with the department, that the advice they received from the Department of Justice, it seems, and DIRCO, was that the bills should have been passed before this is taken, the Marrakesh goes into the House. And so it is pertinent that we clarify where are these two bills. They're way ahead of most of the bills in the NCOP. There are only two meetings left, so they are 90% of the way through them, or 85%. So it is expected that they will get through this in the first week of March, by the first week of March, and it will go to the House then. I mean, when I say to the House, to the NCOP chamber, within a few days. So that being the case, we will ask our committee secretary, Mr. Herman's portfolio committee secretary, to simply monitor that process and alert us. And also, we will, through yourself, Honourable Khadebe, approach the programming whip and the chief whip to alert them to the possibility, to the request that we may need to take this to the House in the last week of our sitting, as it were, of the National Assembly House sitting. All right. Now, are there any clarifications required? And DG, do you wish to speak on anything on the Marrakesh Treaty?
Yes. The issue of Marrakesh is the issue of alignment and sequencing. The advice of the Department of Justice, supported by DIRCO, is that they had requested that the Marrakesh be ratified after the bill has been passed into law. So it's a question of because so that we don't have a misalignment between our domestic obligations and our international obligations and so on. So maybe subject to further legal advice, the proposal would be that given that there is a very strong likelihood of the bill passed into law, that you make your decision to ratify subject to the copyright being passed into law, that so that because it is just there's no objection to ratifying the treaty. It's just that it must be subject to the bill coming into effect. So maybe the exact wording can be worked out with the state law advisors or with the parliamentary legal advisors, but I think there would be a way so that we don't have to come back again to consider Marrakesh.
I think that's a very reasonable proposal, and I'm not a legal fundi, and I think it would be wise if I would be given the opportunity to consult with the parliamentary legal advisor, Mr. Frank Jenkins, on the matter, which will do so with the support of Mr. Herman, so that we can try and contact him today and find out where we are on that. Exactly, can we proceed in that manner? That would be very constructive if that was possible. Now, would there be any objections to adopting that approach on Marrakesh? Consulting our parliamentary legal advisor, any objections? No. So I think that's where we're going to leave it. Are we agreed? Yes. All right, members, we've now reached the point where we have completed the committee's engagement on these WIPO, the treaties, and we'd like to thank the DG and the members in this, especially yourself. There's some members who've been with this WIPO issue for a long, long time, like yourself, Honourable Padiachi. Okay, Miss Padiachi. So let us then allow a changeover to take place. I imagine it would definitely be the DG who remains here, as it were, and one would then want to simply thank Miss Mabiri Misa for taking us through. Thank you very much, and for a really very succinct presentation. Thank you. All right.
The members, just
3-minute break, please, while we do the changeover.
Sorry.